What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dabalina Chakraborty.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And we're continuing on here with our discussion of the Bone Wars, which are also sometimes known as the Dinosaur Wars or the Great Dinosaur Feud. And it's the story of an intense scientific rivalry between two really talented 19th century paleontologists, Edward Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh. And they entered the field at a time when very few dinosaur species were known and competed to find fossils, name the species that those fossils belonged to, and to be the first to publish their findings. And in part one of this episode, we learned a little bit about Cope and Marsh's backgrounds and how they got to be paleontologists, because they took very different paths, as we'll get into a little bit more later. And we also talked about how they started out as friends, or at least as friendly colleagues or acquaintances. I don't know if even their early friendship is what I would...
buddies. Ever.
Yeah, I wouldn't categorize that as a friendship.
But friendly.
Some people do. Friendly. Yes, they were friendly. And we also talked about what exactly it was that caused this enormous rift to form between them.
Yeah, and when we left them off, Cope and Marsh had just started to look west in search of fossils. In this episode, though, we're going to be talking a bit about what they found out west and the sometimes shady tactics that they employed to be the first to get credit for their discoveries. We're also going to take a look at the more official stage on which their battle played out and where it got truly nasty. But first, we want to take a closer look at who these guys were, because it might help provide at least a little more insight as to why they were destined to clash in the first place, the clash of the dinosaur hunters.
Okay, so we've already talked about the differences between Cope and Marsh's socioeconomic backgrounds and their educational training, which is kind of where it all started. And if you'll recall, Marsh was poor, raised on a farm, until his uncle George Peabody stepped in with the financial support that Marsh needed to go to prep school and then on to Yale. And it's Peabody's generous donation at Marsh's request that also led to the creation of a Museum of Natural Sciences at Yale, which was a move that then helped secure Marsh a professorship there, and it created a great resource for him while he was hunting for fossils.
Yeah, he had Yale in his corner. But all of Peabody's support did unfortunately come with a catch, according to an article by James Pennock in American Heritage. It turned out that Uncle George had a certain stipulation for anyone named in his will, and that stipulation involved marriage. When he was 25 and a freshman at Yale, Marsh received a letter from his aunt indicating this stipulation, and it read, quote, "If any of his nephews should in any way conduct himself as to disgrace themselves and him, or, now mind this, should any of them form a marriage connection, or even get engaged before they had the means of supporting a family, they should never have a cent of his money. He desired me to communicate this to all his nephews."
Yeah, and apparently there was one other nephew who had gotten cut out of the will for marrying too soon. So Peabody was serious about this.
He was put to the test.
By the time March was financially independent, he was well into his 30s. So Pennock kind of suggests maybe he was too set in his ways to marry at that point, or, you know, just wasn't inclined to do so.
Or just that he had this strange break on his life until he could be financially independent.
Right.
He had some other friendly sort of issues, though.
Yeah, just basically the issue was that he didn't have many friends. According to an article by Tom Huntington in American History, people found Marsh to be, quote, autocratic and petty, and accused him of taking credit for the work of his assistants and for falling behind on paying his employees, never a good move. At one of his clubs, they apparently nicknamed him, quote, "the Great Dismal Swamp."
That's a bad sign.
Yeah. He doesn't do well with the nicknames,
Mark. No, he really doesn't. Except for the Bone Wars. That one is a pretty great nickname for his rivalry.
True.
Cope, on the other hand, came from a very different kind of background, which we discussed on the last podcast. It was a more privileged beginning. If you remember in the last episode, though, he didn't have a lot of formal education. He was self-taught, and he was a part of this whole gentleman's world of natural science that existed in the 19th century. Dablina and I were talking about it earlier, how it just fascinates us that gentlemen would choose to pursue science in some form.
And there's something very romantic about it. I mean, we both talked about how it just, there's something very ideal about
that. A little
that
troubling, too, because it ends up with, you end up with personal disputes like this. But Cope was considered to be very brilliant, considered to be a prodigy. And his life was also very different from Marsh's on a personal level, too. We mentioned that he was married. He had a wife. He had a daughter named Julia. Unlike Marsh, too, Cope was pretty charming. The friends he had seemed to really like him, really care for him, although they would agree that he could kind of be arrogant sometimes, he could be quick-tempered. According to Huntington's article, paleontologist William Berryman Scott, who took Cope's side in the war with Marsh, said of Cope, quote, "Despite his greatness, in some measure indeed because of it, he had some unfortunate personal peculiarities, was pugnacious and quarrelsome, and made many enemies." So many enemies, many friends, no friends on the other side, kind of unusual guys.
So when we last left off with our story, Cope had kind of broken the mold of those gentlemen naturalists that we were describing. They usually waited for things to be sent to them to study. They didn't actually go out on these great expeditions.
They'd limit their study to the comfort of their own home.
Exactly. And Cope, like Marsh, went out to hunt fossils, but he had a different way of traveling from Marsh. We mentioned how Marsh went out with this entourage and had guides and a military escort. Cope did not have a resource like Yale behind him, so he didn't have all these graduate assistants to come with him. So he often put together teams for his expeditions when he got wherever he was going. Also, since Cope was a Quaker, he rarely used a military escort because he was a pacifist, and he pretty much refused to carry a revolver, which a lot of people thought was crazy because of the threat of hostile Native American tribes out west, among other things.
Yeah, bandits, highwaymen, all sorts of risks he might come across, not to mention just the wildlife, potentially.
Exactly.
Cope did things his way, though, and he was very tough about it. Pennock relates how Cope would read the Bible every night, even when he was out in the field, and if others in his camp would laugh at him, he'd sort of stare them down until they would just straighten up, you know, stop laughing, stop making fun of him. Cope and Marsh did both have successes in the field, though. We've kind of described the way they carried about their expeditions, but they did both have successes. Though Marsh, of course, with his official Yale connection and his Peabody inheritance at his disposal, did have more resources to throw at the situation. However, both, to some extent, Cope especially, were reliant on being associated with one of several geological surveys of the West that were going on at the time. It was kind of an official backing almost.
Yeah, being involved with these surveys provided economic support for their work and a vehicle for publishing their findings. And this becomes important later in our story as well, so just kind of remember that. We talked a little in the last podcast also about how Marsh and Cope started going at each other, mostly by way of letters, after their initial expeditions out west, when they started really competing, in a sense, for fossil finds out there. But they really launched into full-scale warfare in 1877 when Arthur Lakes, who was a mining teacher, wrote to Marsh saying that he'd discovered some fossils near Morrison, Colorado. Now, Marsh didn't reply, so Lakes said, well, okay, I want to do something with these, so he sent some samples to Cope. When Marsh heard that, though, he sent Lakes some cash to win him over. He was like, well, I don't want Cope to get these.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey. Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
After that, after getting that cash, Lakes asked Cope to please send back his samples so that he could work with Marsh. And according to Huntington, part of what Marsh found among Lakes' initial find were the remains, the first remains of a Stegosaurus.
Around the time, the same time, too, another teacher named O.W. Lucas also found some fossils in Colorado. He contacted Cope first about it, and Cope jumped at the chance to check out the fossils. Overall, according to Huntington, Cope's Colorado finds actually turned out to be better than Marsh's because they were bigger and they could be taken out of the surrounding rock without breaking them. Marsh, of course, though, did come out on top in other situations. In the summer of 1877, for example, two railway workers in Como, Wyoming, named William Reed and W.E. Carlin, contacted Marsh about some fossils that they had discovered at a site known as Como Bluff. And Marsh, of course, sent his bone collectors out there. They ended up gathering 30 tons of fossils from the Jurassic Age and shipped all the stuff back to Marsh at Yale. And it was very high quality, you know, large bones. It was well preserved. The result of Marsh's investigation of this find, too, really speaks to how high quality it was. He discovered several new species and named the Allosaurus, the Diplodocus, the Camptosaurus, all from those Como Bluff finds.
And also, notably, he named the Brontosaurus out of those finds, one of the world's best-known dinosaurs and Sarah Dowdy's favorite dinosaur, I should mention. Interesting, though, that the naming of Brontosaurus is actually considered one of Marsh's biggest mistakes. After he died, scientists realized that the creature Marsh had named Brontosaurus was just another example of a dinosaur Marsh had already named, the Apatosaurus. So the designation Brontosaurus was taken away. Obviously, though, that's kind of an enduring
mistake.
Kind of stuck
around.
Yes. So it's probably clear by now that Cope and Marsh often weren't the ones actually digging in the ground, collecting fossils, or even supervising digs themselves. Hence all the talk of sending bones back east to them. They accomplished a lot of what they did through the help of bone collectors. Cope and Marsh would occasionally visit the dig sites, but the fossil collectors were sort of the foot soldiers in this battle that they were waging against each other, too.
There really was a lot of taking sides. Reed took Marsh's side and became a major collector for him, while Carlin switched over to Cope's side. Lucas remained on Cope's side, while Lakes stuck with Marsh. I was surprised by Lucas, I think, since he sort of got slighted at the beginning by Marsh, but I guess
I was
the
too.
Pay might have been better.
Yeah, I mean, that means a lot.
It does. Occasionally, though, according to Huntington again, the two paleontologists would try to woo each other's collectors away from the other. I don't know if they were tempting them with better publication of the works or money all the time, but that wasn't the most extreme of the tactics used in this war. I mean, that already sounds a little bit dicey. But they also spied on each other. Marsh, at least, would even communicate in code with his collectors to try to keep Cope from figuring out what he was up to, what his bone collectors were up to. They referred to Cope as Jones in this sneaky correspondence. And one of Marsh's guys was so paranoid about Cope spying on him that when a man showed up at their camp one day in 1878, he asked for a handwriting sample in case it was Cope in disguise. He was so suspicious.
So I guess they were right to worry, though, because Cope really did charm his way into one of Marsh's camps in 1879, probably to woo some team members over to his side or just to steal information outright. But the funny thing was, Marsh's men really liked Cope. According to Huntington's article, Lakes later wrote of the incident that Cope, quote, entertained his party by singing comic songs with a refrain at the end like the howl of a coyote. And Lakes went on to observe, quote, I must say that what I saw of him I liked very much. His manner is so affable and his conversation very agreeable. I only wish I could feel sure he had a sound reputation for honesty.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
According to an article by Renee Clary, James Wandersee, and Amy Capernelli in Science Scope, Marsh was said to have planted unrelated fossils at some of Cope's dig sites to slow down his progress, too. So it's not just invading the other guy's camp. And
no reputation for honesty there, either.
That takes it to another level,
it
though.
It does.
Tampering with the science, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the really shocking part of Cope and Marsh's tactics, is that they went beyond trying to harm and hinder each other in their efforts. They actually may have harmed the field itself or maybe even hindered scientific progress in some cases. For example, if Marsh's guy Reed unearthed more bones than he could use, he smashed them so that Carlin couldn't get to them.
Marsh is also said to have ordered that certain sites be blown up with dynamite to keep Cope from getting to the fossils. Although, according to a 2008 article by Jean-Vive Rujewski, at least when it comes to one of the sites that was supposedly blown up, Quarry 10, which is in Morrison, Colorado, those allegations are false. Some researchers found Quarry 10 in 2002 using Lakes' field notes and determined that Lakes probably just shoved some dirt in there and then said he dynamited it to discourage the competition from checking it out. The way I sort of read that, though, is maybe he had his history of dynamiting things already established, though, if people were going to believe that.
Could be. While it may have been out west that some of the more colorful war tactics were used by these two, as we hinted in the previous episode, the really decisive battleground for the Bone Wars turned out to be Washington, D.C. And this is where Marsh really pulled ahead, because even though he wasn't winning any popularity contests, he was much savvier when it came to politics than Cope was. The first development that really set the ball rolling for Marsh had to do with those surveys out west that we talked about earlier. In the late 1870s, early 1880s or so, Congress, upon the advice of the National Academy of Sciences, which, by the way, was an organization which Marsh had become president of, decided to do away with all of the existing competing geological surveys and create just one National Geological Survey to replace them.
They decided to call it the United States Geological Survey, and the former head of one of the defunct surveys Marsh had been affiliated with was named as the director. So soon, Marsh became the official vertebrate paleontologist of the United States Geological Survey. Not too surprising there. If he's the head of the National Academy of Sciences already, he knows the new head of the Geological Survey. He was certainly at this point winning the feud in terms of political clout in the science world, in terms of how his career was progressing. When Cope lost that government support, it really devastated his research, too, and his publication efforts. He just didn't have any funding anymore, and his personal wealth, which he had also put toward his efforts in paleontology over all these years, was starting to dry up. Cope, looking for a get-rich-quick sort of scheme, tried to make up for it by investing in a silver mine in New Mexico, but that turned out to be a bust. He lost everything. And it really seemed at this point that there was a clear winner and loser in this feud.
But that didn't seem to be enough for Marsh. He took things a step further and tried to have Cope's fossils confiscated, claiming that they'd been collected with government funds. Cope completely denied this. He said that he had used his own money to collect the fossils. And then he decided to fight back against Marsh in the only way that he could at that point, and that was through the press. He approached a writer for the New York Herald and told that writer basically every bad thing that he had ever thought or heard about Marsh. And this kicked off a very public, very brutal battle of words between Cope and Marsh that was splashed all over the pages of the New York Herald between January 12, 1880 and January 26, 1880, under headlines like "Scientists Wage Bitter Warfare."
And they went way back in their relationship, too. They weren't just considering the last few years as their ammo. They went back to the beginning. According to Huntington's article, Cope said things like Marsh was, quote, unable to properly classify and name the fossils his explorers secured. It's pretty damning. He said that Marsh took credit for his assistance work, and he also accused Marsh and the U.S. Geological Survey of corruption and misuse of government funds, which is pretty key here. For his part, Marsh brought up how Cope rushed to get his discoveries into print, you know, before they were ready, often making errors in the process. He also brought up that embarrassing mistake with the elasmosaur, among other things. We discussed that in the last podcast, flipping the head and tail of the dinosaur and then having Marsh be the one to point it out.
This newspaper feud didn't last long, but it was really damaging to both of their reputations, so nobody won in this instance. Cope struggled to find a buyer for his massive fossil collection because he needed the money. Eventually, he could only sell part of it, and then he hit the lecture circuit and tried to secure a paying position at a college. He didn't have that backing behind him that Marsh had at Yale. I think I saw him described in one spot as a rogue scientist or a rogue paleontologist.
Now he has all this bad press out, too.
Exactly. So doubly, he just doesn't have anyone to go to at that point. it just proved to be really tough to find a paying position.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
According to Penick's article, he finally got a position, though, and a small salary at the University of Pennsylvania in 1889, and he turned out to be a pretty good teacher, but of course, that wasn't his life's goal. That's not what he had really wanted. He died in 1897 of renal failure at age 56.
According to PBS, and not right away, but in a couple years, Congress did investigate the U.S. Geological Survey's use of funds and ended up cutting their funding and completely doing away with the Department of Paleontology. Marsh was forced to resign, and for the first time, he had to accept a salary from Yale. He died of pneumonia in 1899, 2 years after Marsh, at the age of 67. He only had $186 in his bank account when he died, of all that Peabody money that had come to him. His collection ended up in the Smithsonian and at Yale, and part of Cope's collection ended up at the American Museum of Natural History. That's like, those are the two or the three winners in this story, I think. The places and us, too, you know, that we can go see them today.
Yeah, and that there's this interesting story for us to look into. But looking at this result, there doesn't really seem to be, like, a winner at the end. Neither of these guys seem to really come out on top. But, of course, they were both very accomplished overall, and they both made major contributions to science. If you stack up some of their accomplishments, though, side by side, what does it look like? We wanted to take a look at that. So first, we'll look at the naming part of it. Well, Marsh seemed to win when it came to naming dinosaur species. He named 86 out of the 130-some-odd ones that they named total. Cope published more, though. According to Science Scope, his record of 1,200 publications is still unbeaten.
Wow. I mean, I guess that is not too surprising. He won that side of the battle. Marsh notably provided evidence for the theory of evolution, too, which Darwin himself called, quote, the best support of the theory of evolution at the time. He found 30 specimens, for example, that allowed him to outline the evolutionary history of the horse, and he recognized similarities of the modern bird in extinct dinosaurs.
Cope, on the other hand, because of his religious convictions probably, didn't support Darwin's theory, but as Science Scope points out, he's known for Cope's rule, which is the observation that organisms of a species tend to get larger over time in the fossil record. So it just depends on what you're judging them by, which one of them won.
Yeah, and it certainly made me wonder, too, how much they accomplished because they did have the other one there competing and egging him on, or whether they could have accomplished more if they had worked in better concert together than they did, not trying to sabotage each other's work as much.
No, but it's interesting, just another tidbit here, their competition continued a little bit even after the grave. About a century after Cope's death, National Geographic photographer Luis Cejuelos got Cope's skull from the University of Pennsylvania. Cope had willed his body to science, so this was available. And he took the skull with him as he traveled around the world interviewing paleontologists for a book. And he referred to the skull as he was doing this as Eddie. Later, he and paleontologist Robert Baker tried to have Cope's skull named as the type specimen, which means that it would have been the standard of a species to which all others are compared. He wanted to have it named as the type specimen for Homo sapiens. But it turned out that the late botanist Carolus Linnaeus had already been named the type specimen for Homo sapiens.
So thank goodness for Linnaeus, able to step in there with his skull and stop this feud from continuing after death.
Yeah, I read elsewhere that one reason that Cope willed his body to science is that he wanted them to compare his skull size to Marsh's after Marsh died. But Marsh didn't leave any sort of instructions to have his skull studied after the fact. So they didn't ever get to resolve that question.
I think that's for the best.
Yeah, it's better just to look at the story, look at their accomplishments, and decide for yourself, I think, who's the winner. But I'm curious for listeners to write in and tell us if they have a favorite in this war. I know that in the War of the Currents, for example, Tesla was the overwhelming favorite among our listeners, at least. And so I wonder, Cope or Marsh, do you have a favorite, Sarah? Who do you think you would have been pals with?
I don't know. Do I pick the guy who didn't have any friends? I mean, odds are.
Well, you're a nice person, so I could see that.
So I could have made friends with Marsh. I don't know. I found myself during this story kind of rooting for each of them and feeling bad for each of them, and then thinking that they were each terrible, terrible people. So maybe I'll pass on this.
Yeah, okay. You're pleading the fifth.
Yeah. Do you have a pick?
I guess I sort of agree with you, although I found myself sympathizing with Cope a little bit more. And maybe it's because some of the articles that I read were more biased in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it may also have a lot to do with the fact that, at least from what I read, from the evidence that I saw, it seemed that Marsh kind of did the dirtier stuff, like the dynamiting of dig sites. I didn't like that at all. So
it's not cool.
Maybe Cope did it too, but I didn't read any evidence that he had.
Okay, I'll stick to the Brontosaurus.
Stick with the Brontosaurus.
Yeah.
There you go.
Reliable.
No Apatosaurus for
Reliable
you.
Reliable friends. Well, before we go off too far on a dinosaur tangent. So we have a very special listener mail today. Wouldn't you say, Dablina?
Special and delicious.
Special and delicious. It's a bottle of wine.
Yeah, it's a gift we got in the mail.
We got it from listener Dana. And what's it called again?
It's called Brachelle Vineyards Rosé.
We're going to try it out after our recording session, but we wanted to read Dana's note, too, because she had some ideas for future podcasts, too. She wrote, "Dearest Dablina and Sarah, greetings from Paso Robles, California. My husband and I work in the wine industry out here, and we just finished a very long and grueling harvest season. My husband admitted that your podcast helped him through all the brute donkey work that harvest entails, from picks to punch downs to the bottling line. So I wanted to say thank you for providing such a welcome diversion during the most exhausting time of the year. But of course, we do love it." She went on to say, "Please accept this bottle of rosé from the winery I work at as our humble thanks. Sorry, Dablina, it isn't sweet, but I grew up in Atlanta, and I guarantee it's what my mom called a, quote, porch pounder." That's why we're
save it scary
for after the episode. But she went on to say, too, that she figured she would use this opportunity to say that the historic alcohol series we did was their favorite.
Naturally.
For obvious reasons. But she really wanted us to revisit wine as a topic at some point. And a lot of listeners have been suggesting this lately. Something else on wine. Her suggestions in particular were the, quote, cunning, wealthy wine barons of the Rothschild dynasty, or the story of why Charlemagne's wife insisted Burgundy plant more white grapes.
she went on to say, it's very funny, I promise. So
both cool ideas.
Thank you, Dana, for some wine suggestions and for the wine. We're looking forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
And it's a lovely gift and a lovely thing to enjoy, but we're unfortunately going to be partaking of it for kind of sad reasons, or happy sad for us, but happy for our producer and editor Lizzie, who has been with us for a long time. She's been editing this podcast for a very long time, and she's moving on to another really wonderful opportunity. Lizzie is a fabulous photographer, and she's going to be pursuing that a little bit more directly, and we're going to miss her so much.
We are. Lizzie is so fun to work with. She always has good comments on what we're talking about. It's always fun to rehash the subjects with her after recording and sort of let slip our secret opinions on certain topics.
And she always makes wonderful things happen in the editing process. Whenever we have any crazy idea about inserting music into the podcast or anything like that, she always helps us work it out.
Or just cleaning us up, you know?
Yes, making us sound good.
But we are so happy for Lizzie to go off to new and better things. And like Dubliana just said, she's a fantastic photographer. She has a website, lizziephoto.com. It's Lizzie with a Y, as it took me way too long to finally learn. But she's great. Good luck. We will miss you.
Good luck, Lizzie. You will be missed. Keep in touch with us, and hopefully we'll get to see a lot of your great work out there very soon. So on that note, we want to wrap it up and invite anyone who wants to write to us with ideas, comments, questions, anything that is on your mind. We're at historypodcast@discovery.com. You can also find us on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at Mist in History.
And as we mentioned in the last Bone Wars episode, we have so many articles on dinosaurs. We actually have a site director who loves dinosaurs, so it ensures that we are well stocked on all topics paleontology related. So go check that out. It's all in our science section on www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having seven kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch, so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Business. It's all the things that keep this world turning. And behind every one of these companies is a partner helping to keep it all moving. It's why the local flower shop and your favorite pizza joint, the startup in the stadium, hospitals and hotels, banks and restaurants nationwide, all choose the Advanced Network, Cybersecurity Solutions, and round-the-clock trusted partnership from Comcast Business, the company that powers more businesses than anyone else. Comcast Business, powering possibilities.
Restrictions apply. Call or visit ComcastBusiness.com to learn more.